This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Monday, June 15th, 2020. I'm Caleb Brown. It's a pattern that plays out pretty regularly when police or a government agency is given new powers to address a narrow problem. Those powers somehow get used to address other problems. In the case of contact tracing to attempt to limit the spread of the coronavirus, police agencies are already chomping at the bit to use that information for other purposes. Cato's Matthew Feeney and Patrick Eddington comment.
Many listeners will be familiar with contact tracing in the context of the ongoing pandemic as primarily a public health endeavor. The idea here being that in the middle of a pandemic, it's good to know where people are, where they've been. And in pursuing an effective contact tracing regime, governments all across the world have adopted different methods. Here in the US, we've seen lawmakers and officials talking about traditional contact tracing, which is using human beings to track down people and interview them to find out information. There have been other discussions about Bluetooth technology, as well as old-fashioned surveillance. And the worry is, and what Patrick's done a great job of doing at Cato with his Big Brother timeline, is showing how time and time again, the technologies deployed and methods deployed are never reserved for the event or the catastrophe for which they're originally deployed. So whether that's a terrorist attack or a war or a natural disaster, we shouldn't expect for these surveillance technologies to go back in the box they came from. And I don't view COVID-19 as any different. And unfortunately, the confluence of the pandemic with protests about the murder of George Floyd offer, I think, a depressing example of how law enforcement could use the ongoing pandemic as an excuse to gather up more information principally aimed at protesters.
It is natural for law enforcement agencies to want to make use of information that exists that could be useful to deal with some problem, to suddenly apply it to help solve a different problem. Right, Pat?
That has been the history of law enforcement and intelligence activities in the United States for the last 120 years, if you look at the actual full-on record. And we saw it this past week, this repurposing, if you will, of federal assets, whereby the Attorney General, Mr. Barr, issued a two-page memo in which he basically turned the DEA loose on these protesters, allowing them to engage in all manner of covert activity. I mean, he actually spells it out here in the last paragraph of the document itself. DEA special agents and task force officers will, as necessary, one, conduct covert surveillance and protect against threats to public safety. You know, nothing remotely specific about that. Share intelligence with federal, state, local, and tribal counterparts. No limits on that. If necessary, intervene as federal law enforcement officer to protect both participants and spectators in the protest. Now, I think we kind of know how that's been going. And four, if necessary, engage in investigative and enforcement activity, including but not limited to conducting interviews, conducting searches, and making arrests for violations of federal law. I think it's safe to say that probably about the only violations of federal law that we're going to see the DEA engage in this little operation are protesters out there exercising their First Amendment rights. You know, I've been, and I think I'm like you, Caleb. I saw that video of George Brown being
George Floyd.
The only way, yeah, Floyd. Well, they're all running together for me now. I think that's part of the problem. I mean, you go with Eric Garner and you go with Brown and Ferguson and all the rest of this over the last 7-8 years, and that's just in the last 7 or 8 years. And it's just open season on black men in America. I mean, I think most people in the African American community would say it's been open season for 4 centuries, but it's the level of intensity I think that we have seen really can be attributed in large measure to this president. I'm just going over in my mind the image of what happened in Charlottesville with that racist right-wing lunatic driving into that crowd of people. And that's transposed in my mind now with that NYPD SUV driving through a crowd of protesters in New York City just this past week. And for me, it's just been another lesson in this whole issue of how out of control state power can be used to crush people.
What you just described with respect to the lack of specificity of the authorities that have been given to the DEA, however temporarily, reminds me a lot of the fights that we had maybe, I guess it's almost 10 years ago now, over fusion centers.
Yes, which amazingly, when the late Senator Tom Coburn was the chairman of the Senate Homeland Security and Government Affairs Committee, in 2012, they put out a report in which they effectively described these fusion centers as de facto Fourth Amendment violation factories.
So tell me, what are fusion centers and what happened to them?
So these are post 9/11 creations, essentially, at the state level, where state, local, and federal law enforcement all have a presence, and where the data sharing essentially is largely pushed down from the feds to the locals, but a lot of it also flows back up from the locals in the state to the feds. And these things were basically created essentially as, you know, counterterrorism centers. You know, that's how they were sold, as everything else was sold to the public in the post 9/11 environment. And the level of data gathering that they engage in is rather remarkable. And what Coburn and his colleagues found when they did the report in 2012 is that these centers were not responsible for stopping a single terrorist attack on this country, and that they were routinely violating the Fourth Amendment rights of American citizens in each of the states in which these things operated. And they're still operating to this day. I mean, they have become a fixture.
So one of the problems that was identified years ago by Dave Ritkers, who formerly of the Cato Institute, was that these fusion centers, the way that they operated, really short-circuited the process of intelligence gathering, and the people who were essentially in charge of gathering intelligence were people who have no expertise in gathering intelligence.
I would definitely say that was almost certainly the case in the early years of this. It's probably less the case now, and none of us should take any solace from that, because it's a manifestation of the institutionalization of these things. And I continue to point to that whole fusion center phenomenon as just another example of how once some kind of fused law enforcement intelligence entity is created in this country, for whatever purpose, trying to make it go away really becomes virtually impossible. You know, Coburn did his best to get these things defunded when he was in the Senate, but he could never get his colleagues to go along with it. And so they've now become, potentially permanent fixtures, unless we have, you know, a large movement that rises up to essentially, you know, try to defund them.
Matthew, what is your biggest concern with with government involvement in the process of contact tracing using something more technological than actual humans to engage in the process?
My main concern about the technologies that have been outlined is that they won't be reserved to the current moment. I think many of us can imagine a situation in traditional contact tracing where health officials go around and they interview people. And then there are certainly privacy concerns, you know, what's going to happen with those interviews, the paperwork, the digital records about those interactions. But there are discussions about using technologies such as Bluetooth-based contact tracing that are, of course, I think, slightly more intrusive. And private companies can give us assurances about the privacy safeguards they have in place. But we should remember that law enforcement is oftentimes very keen to get its hands on private sector information in order to conduct surveillance that has nothing to do with the initial incident that acts as the genesis of the surveillance. So at the moment, we're in the middle of COVID-19, but there are also protests going on. And I'm reminded of another example that shortly after 9/11, the U.S. government, with its new Department of Homeland Security, started flying Predator drones on the border, the northern and southern border of this country. And only in the last few days, we've seen that those drones have been deployed over Minneapolis in order to keep an eye on protesters. How many people in the wake of 9/11 thought that these new authorities and new pieces of technology would have their cameras pointed at American citizens exercising their First Amendment rights is unfortunately that there are people on that list for sure. Civil liberties activists and Fourth Amendment experts are certainly on that list, but the list wasn't long enough. And I don't think we should be naive going forward in the midst of COVID-19. Whatever technology law enforcement deploy in the fight against the pandemic, they're not going to give it up very willingly or easily because they'll always be able to point to another incident, another disaster for which they think surveillance will act as a remedy.
And in that connection, I should note that this so-called temporary authorization by the Attorney General for the DEA to do all these other things supposedly is only going to last for 14 days with the clock starting on May 31st. So clearly, on or about, I'd say June 9th or June 10th, maybe a little bit later than that, I'll be filing a FOIA to find out whether or not it has in fact terminated, if there is not a formal announcement, or whether some kind of extension has been granted. So I just think we're going to have to keep an eye on all that kind of stuff. And I just want to jump in real quick on this whole issue of contact tracing, particularly like in a digital context. Every one of these contact tracing proposals that involves an app is built on one very, very critical assumption. And that is that the testing itself, the assay testing itself that is done in a laboratory or potentially in your doctor's office, or maybe finally when we actually get, swab kits that we can use for ourselves and, send them in to Quest Diagnostics or another firm. It presumes that those things have a sufficient level of specificity and accuracy to make this entire system work. And what we know right now about the existing tests that are out there is that they don't pass muster. And so what you could wind up with is a situation whereby you get these tests out there. Let's say you have a false positive rate of 5% and a false negative rate of 5%. You're potentially going to be telling thousands of people who are asymptomatic and are not infected that they are infected, and they'll go into quarantine. And you may be telling people who are in fact carriers and are infected that they're not. And they wind up going out there and becoming potentially super spreaders and so on and so forth. So that's my number one issue when it comes to the practical aspect of just trying to do this. We're not there yet. And I don't know exactly when we will be there, if we'll ever actually be there. Hopefully we will. But even after that, a lot of the issues that Matthew has raised, I think, are definitely going to be with us. And given the fact that the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, or HIPAA, has got a very broad law enforcement carve out written into it, I have just general concerns about, the maintenance of any data on people for any kind of length of time that law enforcement might be able to get their hands on for reasons that may have absolutely nothing to do, with actual pandemic containment.
Matthew Feeney directs Cato's project on emerging technologies. Patrick Eddington is a research fellow at the Cato Institute. Subscribe to the Cato Daily Podcast wherever you please and follow us on Twitter @CatoPodcast.